Hello, friends, and welcome to season two of the End Hits Records podcast. This is your host, Ozzy Ronsberger. This season, we will talk in depth about our next release, the reissues of the Better Than 1,000 albums, Just One and Value Driven. This is our fourth and last episode of season two, and my guest today is Better Than 1,000 guitarist, songwriter Graham Land. Graham was a member of seminal straight edge bands Worlds Collide and Battery. He helped to write such classic Shelter songs as Free Will or Civilized Man, and now lives in Sweden with his family. Hi, Graham. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Oisy. How are you?
Really good. In the process, like, as you know, all of us together, we are getting ready to release the Better Than 1,000 discography and to look behind the curtains of that release a little bit. I'm talking to the three key members. So I talked to Ken already. I talked to Ray Capo, and you're the last one I haven't spoken to. So I'm very excited about that.
I'm excited as well.
So when I tried to prepare for this interview, I went through the internet and I could hardly find any interviews with you. I found one essay that you wrote on Double Cross about the first Shelter show ever. And besides that, I couldn't find literally no interviews with Graham Land. What's the reason for that?
Well, I think it was most of the bands that I was involved in sort of stopped before the internet became the main medium for interviews and whatever. And even when I was, you know, I wasn't the vocalist in any of the bands that I was involved with. I wasn't like, I guess I wasn't that into giving interviews. And I gave several in my time, but wasn't usually something that I was that interested in doing, to be honest.
And you mentioned this is your first podcast, right?
Yeah, I used to do a podcast. I did about five sort of environmental podcasts when I lived in London. But it had nothing to do with the hardcore scene or anything like that. It was just me and a friend talking. So, no, I've never been interviewed on a podcast before.
Let's hope this is a good one.
Yeah, it's probably the first and the last.
We'll see. I wanted to know, who did you meet first? Did you meet Ken Olden first, or did you meet Ray Capo first? And do you remember how you met those two guys?
Yeah, pretty clearly. Ken and I grew up two blocks away from each other. So we didn't go to the same school, but I sort of would see him and his twin brother around. Sometimes we used to walk through this little creek, like a little river that was behind his house, and we'd sometimes see them. And I didn't meet him like officially and become friends until I think I was about 15. Mm-hmm. And that was, I was with some sort of punky, skinheady friends, and we went to a band practice, and he was in this band. It was just sort of people that were playing, but they weren't really a band. And that was the first time I met him. And then just the fact, starting to go to shows, and we would see each other around, and the fact that he only lived two blocks away was kind of, you know, when especially back then, you didn't, you know, there wasn't any real hardcore kids in my high school at all. There was a couple of skateboarders and a couple of punks. So, you know, your friends outside of high school, my friends were really through the hardcore scene, and they might, you know, they might live in another state or another town. But just the fact that Ken lived so close, it was like, it was pretty interesting because we could have been friends when we were little kids or something. But, you know, we really became much better friends like toward the end of our teens and mainly in our 20s, I think.
And when did Ray Capo come into the picture?
I had a girlfriend who lived in Pennsylvania. And, well, there was an event in Pennsylvania at this guy. Do you know Smorgasbord Records?
Oh, yeah.
So Chris Daly was hosting a little talk, and some vegetarian food was going to be served, you know, and I was like a 16-year-old. I was straight edge, but I didn't really I wasn't into yoga or Hare Krishna or anything. I didn't know anything about that, but everyone went and everyone listened to Ray talk and you know, he was funny, and he said he was doing a new band, and we sort of like exchanged information, and he sent me a tape of Shelter. I think I corresponded with him a bit, and then I met him at a show in Washington, D.C., and said I was interested in being in it, and he was just sort of, I guess we just got along, and he was, I mean, there was no reason for me to be in any kind of band. I wasn't like, I hadn't played in any known band or even played a show. And then I ended up, you know, recording 7-inch with Shelter in New York before I was out of high school, and then skipping my graduation party and going on tour around the U.S.
So from absolutely being, you know, just like this regular hardcore punk kid into joining this, the most hyped or one of the most hyped hardcore bands, was it weird for you? Like, what did it do to you?
Well, I, you know, I had in my mind that I was like, okay, I wanted to do like meaningful, interesting music. I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, and it was just exciting, and everything was really new. And you know, when you're still in high school, and you know, you get to go to New York and record a record, and yeah, it was true that the first show I was ever played, first real show, was the first show on a tour with Shelter, with Quicksand and Inside Out, and it was sort of the hardcore tour of the summer. And I had no real business being in that kind of band. I was okay at playing guitar, but I had no idea how to really play on stage or anything like that. So I just sort of stood there and played.
How involved were you with Krishna consciousness, or how serious were you about it?
Pretty serious. I just got into it. It was just really interesting, and sort of a lot of new perspectives that I hadn't ever come across before. And really, the people were just sort of like kind of critical of society in a way, and funny in another way. And really, it was a sort of sense of a community where we're all doing something new, especially with the kids. So yeah, I got really into it.
You left Shelter after that tour again, is that correct?
Well, that was the thing. I didn't really like living in the temple as a monk, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. So I was kind of, I was also a moody, kind of depressed teenager. So, you know, it was kind of rough in that kind of lifestyle. So I did leave, and I came back, and then I left, and I would come back, and I was sort of like on and off member for quite a few years, actually.
Because both Ray and Ken told me that you were in New York and started writing material for Mantra with them, right?
That was another thing. I was playing with Shelter, writing songs, and then I played bass on a couple of tours and a bunch of shows, and I recorded bass for the demos for Mantra, which I wish I could hear them. I don't know what happened to them. I think Roadrunner Records owns them, and they're just, you know, I've never even heard them since 1995 or whenever.
So they are rotting somewhere in a vault. Is that the session that Sammy played drums on?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So that's the lineup of Ray, Purcell, Sammy, and you at that point?
Yeah.
Well, maybe one day somebody's going to walk into a basement and find it.
Well, I think probably some, you know, Roadrunner Records was sold or something like that to a major label. And so they probably own all that stuff. So it's maybe not so simple to just, you know, it's not like some hardcore kid has it. It's probably some big corporation.
Yeah. And knowing Ray, he definitely don't has those tapes. That's for sure.
No, I don't have anything. I don't have any tapes at all, if they even exist.
That's true. So you left Shelter right before Mantra came out?
Well, I was the whole time I was sort of filling in and working with, and I had to sort of choose between being in Shelter and being in this band Baby Gopal, which was with Ray's wife at the time, girlfriend, wife at the time. And I wanted to make sort of indie pop music. And I mean, I guess I probably should have stayed in Shelter, really. But, you know, it wasn't the last time I played with them. I played on more tours after that on guitar or bass. And, but, you know, I just always wanted to do something else. And I sort of thought, like, I was thinking career-wise, and I was also thinking about, oh, I want to make sort of indie music. I don't know, trying something different.
then Baby Gopal, they released a record with you in on guitar, I think, on Victory Records after that, right?
Yeah, but I wasn't involved in any kind of release. Those were sort of demos that I had played on, and Ken actually recorded some of them.
Yeah, because you also on the cover, like your picture is definitely on the cover.
Yeah, you know what? My name's not on it. It's weird because it was two 7-inches that were put out by a smaller imprint of Caroline Records in New York, and they sort of this was going to be like we were going to be signed by Caroline Records, and they were really they loved the demos, and they came to see us. They actually bought a club in not they bought a one night in a club for a Caroline Records party to showcase us and maybe some other bands. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. And everyone from Caroline Records came. Lyle Pressler from Minor Threat was the head of Caroline Records at the time. They were really hyped, and we played. And the look on everyone's face was just like, this doesn't sound like the demo sound. Because everyone loved the demos. And I think live, it just didn't come together. So, but then they said, oh, we'll put out some 7-inches on this imprint label. And those 7-inches got re-released and remixed or something like that, and plus some other demo songs onto the Victory record thing. But I was long gone by then.
Okay. Why did you leave at that point?
It wasn't turning out to be what I wanted. Like, I don't think it was a good live band. I think there was some good songs and even some good recordings, but it wasn't going the direction that I wanted. And I was a bit controlling at that time, and I thought, you know, I knew exactly what I wanted, and when it wasn't coming, yeah, I just didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't, you know, I was also getting out of the whole Krishna conscious thing, and I just, yeah, that sort of combined, I think, and I moved back to DC and wanted to do my own thing, and that's kind of when, then I joined Battery pretty soon, and then, actually Better Than 1,000 started before I joined Battery.
When did you guys, like that's between Ken and you, I assume, get the idea to start Better Than 1,000?
I guess that was 1995, 96. And I had left New York, left Baby Gopal and the whole, we were all living together with Shelter and just left that. And I just wanted, you know, there was a whole thing about kind of like getting signed and, you know, with Shelter and with Baby Gopal, we'd been taken out to eat by all these different record companies who were signing New York bands, a lot of them from the hardcore scene. It was when like Civ into another bands like that were getting these big deals on major labels. And it was fun and exciting, but it was really businessy and really sort of fake feeling. So when I went home, I was like, you know, I didn't like that sort of trying to kiss up to people and always trying to get people on the phone to listen to you. And, you know, I'm not naturally an ambitious person. And it just left a really, I felt a bit ashamed of sort of trying to get, you know, sell your music and be a professional sort of, not a pop star, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I did, and I thought the mixing of the hardcore scene with that was kind of distasteful. Mm-hmm. You know, I came from mostly listening to like Discord Records, and they have a completely different ethic. And being from Washington, I just wanted to move back, and I was talking to Ken. I was like, you know, let's do a hardcore band. I don't remember whose idea it was, but I think I had some. I was working on some just like sort of basic hardcore songs, and he wanted to play drums. You know, he's always playing guitar, and he wanted to play drums on something. So we just started jamming. You know, lived 2 blocks away. I was living back with my parents, so yeah.
At this point, you're also the main songwriter in Better Than 1,000, correct?
Yeah, I think those. As far as the music goes, that first Just One was basically all my song ideas, and they didn't get like refined or worked on, or we just sort of recorded them really fast.
What were your musical influences at that point? Like, and what do you think came through in in those songs on the first record?
Probably Minor Threat, early Bad Brains, Gorilla Biscuits. Yeah, and I sort of wanted to do a little bit more stranger kind of chords, like or Dag Nasty a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I really always liked the guitar playing in Dag Nasty. And I kind of wanted to mix it with a little bit. I was really into shoegaze. I still am. So bands like Lush and My Bloody Valentine were like my favorite bands. But trying to hammer that into a hardcore record, I don't think I had the ability to do that. So other than a few airy chords, I don't think that really shows up much in any of the Better Than a Thousand stuff.
I mean, it kind of shows in the instrumentals, right? On both records.
Yeah, there's a little bit. The Cult is kind of what the instrumentals sound like. A little Led Zeppelin in The Cult.
So The Cult is the main influence on Sunshine?
Yeah.
It's crazy. When did you decide to use Ray finally? Like, when was, because I know you tried out a few singers, Ken said nobody famous, but just, you know, kids from around the DC hardcore scene, correct?
Yeah.
And then when did you try, or when did you decide that Ray's going to do it?
Well, I think Ken and Ray were talking because we had all recorded together and we knew each other. So they had been talking separately. I had no idea that Ray would ever want to. You know, he was quite busy with Shelter, and I didn't think he'd want to do like a hardcore band with us. So we had recorded, I think, most of the music for Just One with no vocals. And I started playing in Battery. And I think for a while we just didn't have anyone. And Ken and Ray were talking, and Ray said he wanted to do it. So, I mean, I had never even thought to ask him. I just didn't think he would be into it, but he was.
You named the band, correct? You came up with the band name.
Yeah, I took it from a zine. And it wasn't really a zine. It was kind of like a poetry zine that a friend of mine called Glenn Burns was printing himself. He was doing it like real, like, I think it was just poetry. And he was sort of into, he was into Krishna, but he was... The name came from like some Buddhist scripture, but he named a zine that, and I just thought it sounded so cool, like not like any other band name.
Because there's a Buddhist background, right? A Buddhist poem, if I remember correctly, something to that.
Yeah, I think there's a chapter in some, I don't know if it's the Dhammapada or something. I really don't, and I'm sure I've read it just because, but. Yeah, I think there's a chapter called Thousands, and some of the verses start with better than a thousand.
After Ray decided to be part of the project, you guys drove out to Atlanta,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah.
To record Just One. What do you remember about those recording sessions?
I think the first ones we did when we didn't have a vocalist, and then we needed a few more songs. So we did, what's that song? Well, we had like most of them. We recorded maybe four more with Ray. So what do I remember about that? It was hot. Issa had a very strange sort of, you know, Issa Zhao from Good Clean Fun. It was his studio. So, you know, working with him, I don't really remember all that much. But, you know, really like it was never, I'm not sure it was ever meant to be released as a record. But you know how things are, paying for studio time, especially back then, was pretty difficult. Ken didn't have his studio set up anymore at the time. So we went way down to Atlanta and just sort of, you know, knocked some stuff out. And some of it sounded pretty good. I think we thought we were going to do more and work on it more, or maybe even re-record, but that didn't happen. Revelation wanted to put that out.
I mean, what's really significant on that recording to me is the guitar sound. It's funny that you mentioned Dag Nasty as an influence earlier, but those guitars kind of, you know, sound a lot like Brian Baker's tone on Can I Say, I always thought.
Okay. Well, it doesn't have any chorus on it like they do on Can I Say. It sounds more, I thought it sounded like really mid-rangey and different. I quite liked that sound, actually.
Yeah, it's like this roaring sound. I always loved the guitar sound on that record specifically.
Yeah, it's not that full sort of, you know, thick, heavy distortion. It's more of a, like a barking sound, I guess you call it. Yeah, I like that too, yeah.
In the studio, you're playing obviously all string instruments, bass, guitars. Who was Jeff Newman and how did he come into the picture to play bass for you guys live?
Jeff was a guy from Richmond, just a very likable guy. And he was in, he was actually a roadie for Battery on a tour, like a 6-week European tour. We didn't really have a bass player. We sort of had this guy called Hiro, this Japanese friend of mine who was living in Maryland. And, but you know, I guess, we hung out with Jeff a lot and he said he played bass and he was into it and he was really good, like jumping around and stuff. And we all got along. So he sort of, yeah, he didn't play on that recording. That's true. But you know, he learned the songs and yeah. And he's got like he had a good look and he looked good in photos and his photos ended up a lot of places.
Oh Jesus. The one where he's jumping, you know, at the back of, the back cover of the Just One, and there's a bunch of other.
Someone got that tattooed on them, which really? Is I know everyone has a tattoo of everything now, but back then that was like,
yeah, definitely a very photogenic guy, that's for sure. So like Ken remembered all those things very, you know, in detail. It's great. Mm-hmm. He has a great memory. So he said you didn't even play that many shows in the in between, you know, recording, releasing Just One. Yeah. And that you guys were desperate to get back into the studio to record Value Driven. But at that point that you guys were like having, you know, bigger issues, or Ray was having bigger issues with Roadrunner and having him under contract with Shelter, which finally led to you guys recording at Ken's home.
Yeah, there was something about him. He couldn't be credited with writing anything. Mm-hmm. I think it was that he was allowed to like, you know, perform on it, but there was something about like, so I think the credits didn't say his name as far as like songwriting goes, but I'm not sure. I don't know what it says on, you have that information. I don't really have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just One, it says lyrics by Better Than a Thousand.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. I mean, we did collaborate on lyrics for, I think a lot of that stuff. Some of it's all him. I think most of it's all him.
Ken mentioned that you think the lyrics in the original Just One version all are kind of wrong, right?
Yeah, the lyrics were printed wrong, but that's because I think he's fixed it, because I went through the ones that were wrong on the official, or you know, whatever I found on the internet, which is taken from the Revelation lyric sheet. Yeah, they were wrong because I think Ken never had a copy. And Ray had sort of a notebook that he was just sort of scribbling lyrics in, and they were a bit hard to make out.
So after that, you went into Ken's house and bathroom, basically, right, to record yeah. Value Driven?
Yeah, he had these things, these ADATs. They're like digital beta tapes, and he had a little mixing board. And yeah, I think the drums are in his bedroom. The bathroom was the vocal booth. Guitars, bass, all in his bedroom. That's a little bedroom too.
But you were also sharing the songwriting on that album, correct?
Yeah, about 50-50.
Do you remember what the reason was for that?
Yeah, because Ken's a good songwriter. He wanted to play guitar. He still played drums in the record, but I think the whole idea was to get, he wanted to play guitar. He'd, you know, he played the first, I don't know, at least 10 shows, probably more, on drums, but I think he missed being up there and out there on guitar.
That's when you got Alex Garcia, right?
Yeah, Alex. I'd played in Shelter with Alex and Baby Gopal as well. We liked him a lot and we knew him well, and he could play anything.
What did he bring to the table? So once, you know, Ken switched to guitar and Alex sat in on drums.
Well, Ken is kind of like a solid drummer, but he's really a guitar player. He's kind of like, I mean, he's one of like the best and most unique guitar players that I've ever played with, for sure. And even just like listening to him, that's, he's very precise and has a very like, he should be on guitar, is basically yeah. what I'm saying. And Alex, you know, is a great drummer, like really flashy and fancy and like I said, he can play anything you want him to. So I think it was just to bring it up a level, having two guitars and, you know, and a really great drummer.
Yeah.
You know, that, for me, it didn't matter that much, but the results were really good. So it kind of like, you know, you play a couple of albums and then you go on tour with a better lineup, improved lineup with like more musicianship, and then you never record again. or we record like a couple songs for some compilations.
That lineup you also took on tour right afterwards. And if I understood it correctly, you guys really were active as a live band after Value Driven came out.
Yeah, we did. I kind of thought we did a few. I'm trying to think of the tours. We did a couple of US tours plus some, you know, shorter, you know, four or five shows at once. And a couple of European tours as well. Plus we went to Brazil and other parts of, where was it? Colombia, I think. No, it wasn't Colombia. Brazil, Chile, and Argentina, and Puerto Rico.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, at that time, wasn't many American hardcore bands going to those places.
And weren't Shelter kind of rock stars anyhow in Brazil?
Yeah, they were. I had been on a couple of, I went on a Brazilian tour with Shelter, and it was a completely different atmosphere. You know, people staying overnight in the hotel lobby and coming down and, asking for your autograph in the morning, doing, you know, signings at record stores, that kind of stuff. I had never done anything like that before.
How was it to come back with Better Than a Thousand to those places then? Did you kind of catch the same?
It was almost reversed. It was almost like Brazil. There were some hardcore shows that were really great and big. And then there was some, you know, really small ones with, you know, 40 people or something like that. It wasn't like with Shelter, but the strange thing is in the Spanish speaking countries, which we only had two shows in, they were massive. And that was because this woman who worked at MTV Latino, which was based in Miami, I think, but broadcast all over the Spanish-speaking or Latin American countries. She started playing our, we had a little video for We Must Believe.
Oh, I remember that one, yeah.
And it became like a little hit. And we had a record company in Argentina. And I think they had a little hit. And so there was like, you know, heavy metal kids at the show. With Ozzy Osbourne shirts. It was like a concert. It was some very dangerous underground club. I don't mean like it was dangerous because it was overcrowded and there was just water everywhere and the electricity was sort of, you could feel like literally feel your amp being electrified. But yeah, no, that was interesting. And I have no idea how many records were sold, or we had like a professional guy put out the record down there. It was a punk guy, but I think he told me, I owe you thousands of dollars. I can't pay it. So I owe you this much. And that was the last time I spoke to him. I think he had a drug problem. He was very honest about it, but
he was an honest addict. That's great.
I mean, it was basically like, I don't know. He had some kind of thing where he didn't have the money. But I think, you know, they put, it was the same with all those American indie hardcore labels. They take the money that they make, yeah. They put it into something else, and then they lose it.
Yeah.
Whatever. We had a great time. I don't think he was like, he wasn't trying to rip us off. He just, you know, I think that was the same with a lot of hardcore labels.
More incompetence, right?
Yeah, and they, you know, they don't have a big major corporation to back them up and honor contracts and things like that. It's some guy or some kid or fall on hard times. They don't have, like, they can't afford to pay.
At that point, a lot of those tours, you were also doing double duty, right? Battery, yeah. And Better Than a Thousand.
Yeah.
How did that go for you? Like,
I did not like it. Because at the time, I was kind of like loading a lot of my own equipment too. And in America, it's just like, Europe, I can do that. You have, you know, someone driving you. It was a lot of work. But in America, it was, you know, 10, 12-hour 15-hour drives, and we were basically Ken and I were the only people driving, and not into that. And I was setting up my own amps, both the bass stack and then the guitar stack right after. Yeah, and I wasn't sleeping, so that kind of bummed me out. And then my wallet was stolen in L.A., so I had nothing. I had no ID.
Oh, no.
The Whiskey A Go-Go, you know that club?
Oh, yeah, very well.
Like a famous rock and roll club. And I don't know. We had like a guard on the door, so I left my wallet and my backpacks because I didn't want to have this big, you know, in my shorts or whatever on stage. And, I'm pretty sure the guy that was guarding the door took it. It was like a biker. I asked him about it, and he didn't. He just shook his head.
So your driving days were over after that?
I was fed up, and I flew home. But, you know, in those days, it was like before September 11th. So they're like, oh, you need your driver's license or passport or something to fly home. And, well, somebody stole it. And they said, well, okay. I had a police report. The guy from No Doubt, the bass player from No Doubt, drove me to the police station to get a police report.
Ah, Tony.
Yeah, he was. He would hang out with the band and He came to a bunch of shows. He actually went on tour with us for about 4 days, and that's when they were the biggest band in the world.
Yeah,
I don't know why he would do that.
Hey, he probably just missed that kind of touring.
Sitting in a van with a bunch of guys with nothing to do, you know. But yeah, I guess you're right.
So after, you know, all this happens, you play all these huge festivals in Europe. Tours. There's like this huge, yeah, some pictures of, you know, Dynamo Festival, a festival in Spain, one in Italy. All of those look gigantic. So the band supposedly, or not just supposedly, the band is more popular than ever.
It's hard to know. It's hard to judge the popularity of a band on a festival. Like I said, like when we were in Argentina and that like big crowd came, yeah, I knew why, because this woman had put us in MTV a lot. But Madrid, the guy, it was a hardcore guy called, I think his name is Vicente. He put out a set. We put all these 7 inches in different territories at that time. Sweden or Scandinavia, Germany, Japan, Spain. And the one, the guy Vicente who put it out in Spain, he ran this place, this festival called Festimad, and it had Metallica and the Black Crowes. And he put his own bands on it. Nobody knew who we were at Festimad. It was a gigantic festival with Metallica. And we got to play, I think we played before Skunk Anansie or something like that. You know, these are bands that people knew. So there'd be like a pocket of 50 hardcore kids in the corner. And, you know, festivals, people tend to like whatever.
You still, let's say, ended the band kind of on the height of its popularity, right?
I guess so, yeah.
Do you know when it fell apart? I remember there was this Italian incident that, you know, kind of got blown out of proportions, the beginning of internet and message boards about Ray supposedly not being straight edge anymore, blah, blah, blah. But was that really the end of it? Like, did the band fall apart at that point, or was it something else?
I was reading any message boards, but I did... Yeah, there was a lot of, you know, personal stuff, and Jeff left in Brazil, but he, you know, he got like mugged by these junkies in São Paulo, and that was pretty traumatizing. So he left, and he never joined again. So I just played bass in the rest of the Latin American tour, and I think after that we only played like 3 shows in Portugal. And 1 show in that festival, Festimad, in Madrid. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe like a club show in Madrid too. And I think we wanted to do another record, but it didn't happen. I think Ken and I recorded music, and with Alex as well. But it sort of became Face the Enemy with Tim from Mouthpiece. But those should have been better than 1,000 songs, I guess, or they would have been.
Did you ever officially break up or did it just fizzle out at the end?
You know, it wasn't the kind of band where it's like, this is your life. So, you know, everyone had other stuff going on. It was kind of like the fun band to do when you have time. So it wasn't mm-hmm. like this thing like, you know, I got to have a meeting with everyone and we're going to end this thing that's like when big bands break up. No, sort of. A normal hardcore band for me only makes a couple of records. One, two, maybe three. Mm-hmm. Those are the real classic hardcore bands. So for me, it's not like, I was disappointed. I think at the time I really liked it and I really wanted to keep doing it. But I also was sort of like in the process of relocating, moving to Sweden. So, and I wanted to do, I kept wanting to do indie music.
Okay.
I didn't give that dream up for a couple of years.
To play in your shoegazer band?
Yeah, I wanted to do that. And I actually ended up doing that and making a record or like a little EP. And then finally gave it all up, went to university.
But you still, parallel to that, you still played in Shelter again, right? Because you're on the promo pictures for When 20 Summers Pass.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I did. I had gone to Sweden and... Yeah, and then I got this opportunity to do a U.S. tour, a European tour, and a Latin American tour with Shelter for 20 Summers Pass. Yeah, forgot about that.
You still got sucked in again.
They're always kind of like, it was always nice to go back. And I mean, Shelter for me was always like something I could play. I could always play the bass or the rhythm guitar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, they knew they could count on me and, but then again, I was always, I couldn't just keep doing it. I wanted to start my new life. So I didn't last again.
When you look back at, Better Than 1,000, like you guys did a lot in a very short period, right? That's probably two and a half years max.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
What do you think the legacy of the band is?
That's really hard for me to say. For me, it was like kind of getting back to playing the kind of hardcore that I liked when I was first discovered the music, but never really played. Like my first band that I played with was Shelter, and that was kind of a more experimental kind of post-hardcore band. Then I played in Worlds Collide, and then then I played in Battery, so I guess it was kind of like Battery was like the real first real like hardcore typical fast mm-hmm. songs and stuff like that. But that was sort of like at the same, that was joined that Battery after I had started Better Than 1,000. So for me, it was more about the experience. I mean, it wasn't about like working really hard and to write songs and record them. It was more about just doing it. And like I said, everyone had other bands that they were more active in and more sort of mm-hmm. dedicated to. Everyone as in like, Ray and Ken. And for me, I was kind of split between Battery and Better Than 1,000 and just sort of writing indie songs. yeah, but it was really about the experience for me. As far as the legacy, I think, I think it's like your generation for like, if you're young and you see, a band that's sort of like hot at that time, hot, not listen, just popular, but like means something to you,
mm-hmm.
that's for the sort of the people who are at the shows, really. For me, it was sort of like, I was getting a little older. I think we're all getting a little older. And we say that now when people are still playing in hardcore bands, but it felt like that at the time.
Yeah,
I think the music has, aged with the people. But I didn't think I was doing anything. I still don't think it was something, a classic kind of thing. It's sort of like, you remember what life was like at the time. And that's what it is, when I was 13 and I first heard, Minor Threat or something like that. Or really got to see, So, for example, when I saw Fugazi for the first time, that's very meaningful. I'm not comparing us to Fugazi. I think we were more like, let's do something fast and aggressive and have a good time, when instead of all this music business stuff that was kind of happening, especially with Shelter. And, mm-hmm. when I was playing in Baby Golf Ball, it was a bit like that. Like I said earlier, sort of, left a bad taste in my mouth, trying to be a business So something like Baron of Thanos is easy, fun, good experience. No major stuff. No, like, you know, put it out ourselves. Revelation, then we'd put it out ourselves.
Very back to basics approach.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just a fun time. It was kind of like not quite an adult yet, even though it was, you know, mid-20s almost. It felt like, you know, was it able to, like, you know, able to go on tour and sort of like take a little job in a shop somewhere. You know, I used to walk dogs when we weren't on tour. You know, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Now that you're playing, like, you're in Battery again, like, you're doing reunion shows.
Yeah.
I think you guys are talking about doing Better Than 1,000 shows as well. How does that feel to you to go out again and kind of, the way you described it, you know, there's people that were young when those records came out, they saw Battery, they saw Better Than 1,000, that's connected to a memory. How do you feel to perform those songs and be part of, yeah, kind of a nostalgic trip for people?
Yeah, well, there are some younger people that come out, but a lot of them are amazingly the same. So it's like, it's not like we're playing in front of people half our age. We're basically playing in front of people our age with actually quite a good range. But I mean, it hasn't happened with Better Than 1,000 yet. It might happen mm-hmm. a couple shows or something, one or two with Battery. Yeah, really nice. I mean, with all the everything that's changed as far as like technology, internet, and I haven't been playing in between. I basically played, you know, I think the last thing I did before Battery did a reunion was like a Shelter show in the 2001 in the summer,
mm-hmm.
and then nothing until like 2015, something like that. And that was just a couple of Battery shows. And then this last summer, we went on tour with H2O.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is different. You know, everyone's got kids. So much time has passed. But then again, like when you're with your friends that you were sort of grew up with, so much is the same. So I think like, yeah, and it seems like that a little bit with shows. They're just not like people flying around doing stage dives and all this like acrobatic stuff that you can do when you're 16. So it's a bit, you know, it's a bit different in that way. But no, it's not that different. And everyone's really good at playing music. That's what I should say. I don't mean me. I mean,
okay.
Every band you see is like technically good. And that mm-hmm. was not the case before. People could like couldn't play. So if you could play a little bit, like I could play a bit. I felt like I could play better in those days than like most bands that we would play with. But now it's like the opposite. You know, I can play my parts, and I'm probably a lot better than I used to be, just because I don't know why, but I have more time, or I don't have more time, but I, you know, I'm just playing these songs. I'm not playing. I don't have to learn any new songs, but. In general, the kids that have hardcore bands now are really good.
Especially the drummers.
Everyone.
The drummers got so much better.
And that was always the important thing. It was always hard to find a good drummer. And I don't know, people are just like, I don't really know what happened because I haven't been paying attention. You know, recording technology is really good too. So they can fake it as well. But on stage, they're good too. I don't know, I feel pretty lucky that I got to do all this stuff and people liked it when, you know.
You mean when the technical aspect wasn't that important?
It was, if you thought it was important and you wanted to try to get something technically good, like production-wise, that was a struggle. And you had to put time and like studio time in, and that costs a lot of money. And if you look at like some of the people in these bands, Ken had a studio. Alex now has a studio. Brian was, you know, from Battery, was had pretty big studios producing lots of bands. So they really like got into that because it was almost like they had to.
Are you interested nowadays in still writing that kind of music? Like, would you be looking forward to, let's say, record more Battery music or record more Better Than 1,000 music?
I've got some guitars and I've like recorded some ideas for songs, but I'm not looking for anyone else to play with. So, I mean, I like Battery. That's the only band that I've been active with lately. I don't think that anything's going to happen with any new recording with any band. I won't say never, but I don't expect that to happen. I've only had guitars in my possession for the last few years, 5 years maybe. And, you know, I took a break from all music for 10, 15 years, didn't touch anything. So it was very weird to come back, like when you think you're already old and say like Battery and Better Than a Thousand Ends, and you feel like you're kind of old for hardcore. And then you come back like 20 years later. You know what I mean? That's like, and you're like, if you think you're old then you're really old now. But it didn't, like I said, on tour, it worked fine. Because, you know, it was the same people, same audience.
I think that's actually a pretty good time to wrap it up. Hey, Greg, thanks a lot, and have a good evening in Sweden.
You too.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much for listening to the End Hits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care. No way. You have to jump down, so damn